from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. 37 people were arrested and 17 police officers injured after neo-Nazi protesters surrounded Ukraine's parliament in Kiev, demanding special recognition for World War II-era pro-Nazi Ukrainian veterans. According to the Ukrainian Interior Ministry, Kiev police had to deploy additional forces around the parliament building after demonstrators threw smoke and stun bombs at officers when the parliament failed to enact a measure. The vote was set on Tuesday, the anniversary of the UPA, an armed Ukrainian nationalist organization that sided with the Nazis against the Soviet Union. That group was charged with war crimes after the war, including the killings of Jews and Poles in Ukraine as the Soviets fought off the Nazi invasion. Ukrainian nationalists from the Svoboda Party and the Radical Right Sector Movement, who had been celebrating the anniversary, made up the crowd encircling the parliament building. Meanwhile, service members from the Ukrainian National Guard protested outside the presidential headquarters in Kiev Tuesday, demanding that the military be withdrawn from the eastern regions of the country. Despite the ongoing ceasefire agreed to on September 5th between the government and rebel forces in the east, the Organization for Cooperation and Security in Europe monitors have reported continued shelling in the eastern region of Donetsk and Lugansk by government forces. At least 331 deaths have been reported in Ukraine since the ceasefire was signed, according to a recent United Nations report, with 3,660 killed since April. The service members claim that they've spent more than a year at their posts in the disputed eastern regions and were demanding to be sent back home. They claim the government is in violation of the terms of their service contracts. There were clashes on the streets of Hong Kong between pro- and anti-government protesters, with anti-government marchers putting up barricades against police and others taking them down. Meanwhile, Hong Kong's CEO has called for calm. We have this from the Chinese news agency, CCTV.
Hong Kong Chief Executive Lun Chun-ying met with some Hong Kong residents in Guangzhou at a forum focusing on Pan-Pearl River Delta regional cooperation. Lung said the current situation in Hong Kong isn't likely to last much longer, and the Hong Kong government expects life in the city to return to normal as soon as possible.
Under the premise, there were no major clashes with the protesters. We hope all aspects of Hong Kong society to get back to normal as soon as possible. The Hong Kong police used the lowest level force when they needed to deal with the clashes among citizens or to stop activities that seriously violate the public order and social security. Such low-level police force is rare all around the world, including in some Western democratic countries. The Hong Kong SAR government and police will maintain their high level of tolerance. But we should know that this is not only about public complaints. The current situation cannot be allowed to continue.
Bolivian President Evo Morales won a landslide victory in Sunday's election for a third term. We have this report from Press TV.
Incumbent President Evo Morales has been elected to a third term. That's according to the preliminary results announced by the Supreme Electoral Tribunal. Earlier surveys showed that Morales, who is Bolivia's first indigenous leader, had a commanding 59% support heading into this election. That puts him more than 40 points ahead of his nearest rival, Samuel Doria Medina. Now, Morales now extends his time in office to 14 years until January 2020. He has garnered support for alleviating poverty since taking office in 2006. Joining us now is political commentator Marcelo Sanchez. Many thanks for joining us here on Press TV, Mr. Sanchez. Now, the exit polls are in, and it seems that Evo Morales is going to secure victory quite comfortably. Are you at all surprised?
Well, not actually. Let me tell you a little story about Bolivia. Back in 2003, there was a president named Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, and he actually ran away from the country with millions of dollars in cash in a private helicopter, and now he lives in Miami in a comfortable and very luxurious mansion. And between 2003 and 2006, there was a political void in the terms of who was going to be the next leader of Bolivia. In this point, people was trying to get something, some answers, and there was this obscure figure coming from Chapare, which is the coca region in the central part of Bolivia. His name was Evo Morales, and he was a coca farmer with no education, no political background, no intellectual titles or diplomas. And suddenly he had the charisma that Bolivians were looking for, and he took over, and he took over the hearts and minds of Bolivians. And as of now, we've seen a third term of this president. He changed the whole picture in Bolivia with leftist and social ideas that really changed the existence of the people, because you have to remember that the six million people are expected to vote today, but 10 million people in Bolivia are indigenous people. And this culture of abuse and humiliation was for more than 500 years against these people. So suddenly they have a figure in Morales, and they just rebelled against all the status quo that we've seen during many, many years of money domination, colonialism against the Bolivian people.
Well, it hasn't, though, been very smooth for Evo Morales during his tenure as president. Let's not forget there were protests that took place in Bolivia against his development projects.
Well, there was a lot of opposition, but Morales blames this type of movements to foreign intervention. In fact, it is proven that the U.S. had put a lot of money into nonprofit organizations in order to break democracy and institutions in Bolivia, in order to discredit the government of Morales. Let's say that they accuse Morales of being a drug dealer or supporting drugs and cocaine, but let's remember that the U.S. supported the drugs and the cocaine during the 1970s with the Plan Condor and these military governments, so they had the free hand from the U.S. to do whatever they wanted as long as they kill communists. And once we have a socialist president that he's trying to do something for the actual people, the U.S. and other powers go and they try to change the situation. But also, I would like to finish with something that we have to look the greater picture of what's going on in Latin America. And it is that several countries are trying to forge strategic alliances to break colonialism, such as Bolivia, Cuba, Venezuela, and the intervention and the businesses and all the cultural cooperations that these countries have with such countries such as Iran, Russia, China. And we've seen a change in the panorama in Latin America, and this is something that certainly the U.S. does not like at this point. So we are not really surprised that Morales is going to be the next president on a third term in Bolivia.
Right, and very quickly, if you can, Mr. Sanchez, we have six more years of Morales now. What do you see this term going to be defined as?
Well, Morales promised that the product of the country is going to increase to 6.5% in the next presidency, and people believe this. We've seen a lot of development in construction and mineral projects. There's also lithium in Bolivia. These are unexplored resources that certainly those are not going to be in the hands of transnational corporations, but in the hands of the Bolivian people, because he nationalized the gas industry, for example, and this was a great source of revenue for the country, and this increased certainly the quality of living for the Bolivian people.
The British House of Commons voted to recognize the state of Palestine in a non-binding vote. The move is symbolic but significant, as Marina Korsarova reports from London.
Well, it's important in that it sends a very strong message, which is exactly what the opposition Labour Party was hoping for. And 274 MPs voting in favour of recognising Palestine versus just 12 who were against definitely does just that. Now, emotions were running high throughout the four-hour debate, with MPs saying it would be morally the right thing to do, voting yes, that is. We heard MPs referring to the extensive use of force and violence against civilians, as well as, of course, the extent of the humanitarian crisis there. And of course, many even said that Israel has now lost its moral high ground and it was time for Brits to act, considering they believe that their country's foreign policy is now stuck at an impasse. Now, even though most MPs agreed on the need and urgency of a two-state solution, they did point out that it couldn't be achieved without dialogue, without negotiations on both sides. Now, also, we know that even though the British Prime Minister, as I said, did abstain from the vote and made his position quite clear, even from his own party, the Conservatives, they did hear, for example, recently, Baroness Vazey, one of the ministers, resigned over David Cameron's reluctance to condemn Israel's actions in stronger terms and called that position a morally indefensible one. Well, this is what we're waiting to hear now. Now that the Parliament has voted in favor of recognizing Palestine, what will be the reaction in Israel and, of course, its closest ally, the United States? Because we heard the reaction when, example, Sweden became the first Western European country to recognize Palestine. There were reports that, of course, Israel's foreign ministry summoned its Swedish ambassador to give him an official reprimand. So it'll be interesting to see the reaction to this vote in the morning.
Solving the problems of Gaza is the only way to peace. That, according to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, Stephanie Kutrix reports.
The only way to avoid another tragic conflict in Gaza in the future is by tackling the root causes of instability in the territory, according to the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Mr. Ban on Monday visited Palestine and Israel after attending a donors meeting held in Cairo, Egypt, on Sunday for the reconstruction of Gaza following the conflict in July. During his meeting with Palestinian Prime Minister Rami Hamdallah in Ramallah, the West Bank, Mr. Ban stressed the need to stop what he called this endless, needless, mindless cycle of suffering. In Jerusalem, where he met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the Secretary General said the conflict left what he described as unprecedented levels of damage and pain for thousands of civilians living in the Gaza Strip. He added Israelis repeatedly lived with constant fear for their own lives and safety and security, running for shelter at a moment's notice. He thanked Prime Minister Netanyahu for supporting the UN broker agreement on a temporary Gaza reconstruction mechanism. Mr. Ban said the mechanism has opened the door for much-needed reconstruction, taking fully into account Israel's legitimate security concerns. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
The large-scale reconstruction of Gaza must start without delay, according to the UN Secretary General. Much of the territory was razed to the ground and more than 2,000 civilians killed by the Israeli military operation against the city in July. The UN chief was due to visit Gaza Tuesday. Chris Gunness, a spokesperson for the UN agency handling support for Gaza, spoke with Reem Abaza about the goals of the Secretary General's visit.
It's extremely significant, and we are looking forward very much in UNRWA to hosting the Secretary General, who was last here in 2012. I think one of the most significant parts of the visit will be the meeting with members of the Government of National Consensus, and it will be the highest level in Gaza that there's been a meeting between the UN and officials from the government. So that's important. But I think more generally, the people of Gaza have felt so isolated and so beyond the reach, in a sense, of diplomatic norms and international diplomacy, even international law perhaps. So it's hugely important that the world's top diplomat comes. He's the man who has been to Gaza in its time of need before. I remember being there with him in 2009 after our warehouse has been struck. And he was visibly emotional and moved. And I think he feels very viscerally and from his heart a profound sense of association, if you like, with the victims of conflict, and particularly victims like those in Gaza that he has spoken out so passionately and with such commitment before. So we're looking forward to having him in Gaza. And I think for the people of Gaza, it's a truly historic and momentous moment.
Here in the U.S., Ferguson, Missouri police Monday arrested Dr. Cornel West and other religious leaders participating in a march over widespread police shootings of young black men. After a weekend of protests throughout the St. Louis area, the group that included Dr. West was met with riot gear-clad police in front of the Ferguson Police Department. RT's Lindsay France was on the ground and has more details.
It's been relatively peaceful, especially compared with what we saw last summer in the immediate aftermath of Michael Brown's killing. There's been a big push on the part of protest organizers, Michael Brown's parents communicating with protesters and locals to have a peaceful protest, to have peaceful positivity, to make the changes that they want to see within the police department and within their own communities. Now, of course, there have been verbal confrontations, there's been tear gas, and there's been now arrests. In fact, 42 at the police station just today. And as you said, prominent activist and professor Cornel West was among those arrests. Now, no word yet on his status, if he's been released or where he is right now. But of course, we're going to be following that very closely. There is showing what the media is seeing here, just to be clear, is a real difference in the generational approach to this problem. Things have evolved, and younger people want to handle things differently than I think some of the older generations think they should be handled. The younger people tend to be more confrontational. They want to be on the street and have their presence known to the public, to the police, to lawmakers. And they don't want to shy away from that. The older generation seem to want to take a quieter, more diplomatic approach. And therein lies the problem. And they're really trying to sort that out. You can really sense that here. So it's been a weekend of some violence when the protests, especially taking place in front of the police station, are going on. And the line that they make for protesters to not go past are being approached very closely. I have seen a few instances of police putting on all of that gear, and it really does rile up the crowd. They cannot be unaware of the fact that it riles up the crowd, because it looks like they're about to take action. But really, there is a more laid-back approach. They're really watching their P's and Q's, from what I can gather, and those are my observations as a reporter on the ground. These people are really watching their P's and Q's. They're really walking a tight line here. They know they're unpopular. They've got to be very careful of what comes out of their mouth and what they're carrying on their person. Now, today at City Hall, for instance, just behind me here in St. Louis, a crowd went in and essentially took over the foyer. And what they're really trying to push for are a list of demands that they want to see changes within the police department. So they went into City Hall, and we talked to one of the protest leaders about what they want. Now, this is St. Louis. There was a shooting here last Wednesday of a young man who police say was carrying a gun and shot at a cop. When the cop turned around and shot him, he's since lost his life. However, there's a lot of dispute in this case, and these protesters say if the cop had been wearing a body camera, there would be no gray area. So we talked to one of the protest leaders here at City Hall, and this is what he had to say.
The list of demands was body cameras worn by all St. Louis City police officers that have any interaction with the public whatsoever. Part of that was there's been a lot of a lot of confusion where the money's going to come from. And yet, they have the money set aside for a real-time intelligence center. I feel like having body cameras on your police officers is a little more important than having surveillance means for everybody in the city. You wouldn't have a lot of the issues that you have in the Shaw neighborhood if you had police officers with body cameras on, because there would be less gray area.
The protesters, the young protesters anyway, took over City Hall here behind me. We're now filtering out through the foyer of the lobby. You can see here behind me the signs that they've put up here. We are the people, we have the power. And this displays so well the difference between what the older generation that is a part of this movement is putting forth and what the younger generation is putting forth. We saw last night at St. Louis University when the faith leaders and the civil rights leaders were talking to the crowd. They were talking about injustice and peace, et cetera, et cetera. They were coming at it even from a very academic standpoint. But the young people here are fueled by anger, and they want change to come in an uncomfortable way almost. They want to keep it on the street and keep it in front of the authorities' face. They don't just want to talk at the table, and we're seeing that right here. So if you come this way, you can see the group amassing near the front now. They've been in here for a little over an hour, and the guards at the front are blocking people out. We got in through a side entrance, but on the fourth day of Ferguson, October. We're still seeing this momentum, and leaders here say that we're not going to see any slowing down, especially when the grand jury decision of whether to or not to indict the officer that killed unarmed Michael Brown is, when that decision is made, we'll then see a difference. But as for right now, the momentum is still here as that decision is waited on for at least another couple of weeks. In Ferguson, Lindsay France.
And on Tuesday, police arrested at least 50 more in demonstrations across the St. Louis area, which included the occupation of City Hall. Monday was celebrated in some quarters in the United States and officially as Columbus Day, while others remember the indigenous people of the region and what was done to them. Abel Macias is an artist, teacher, and activist who maintains the blogspot Native Journey, Culture, and Resistance. He laid out the genocidal history surrounding the Columbus holiday in an interview with Liberation Radio's Ernesto Aguilar.
I used a book by Howard Zinn. It's called A People's History of the United States, and I'm sure many listeners have heard of the book and have maybe even used it in a classroom. It's very, very popular. And so what Howard Zinn does is, you know, quote word for word what Columbus wrote himself in his journal. And you know, some of the things that Columbus talks about is enslavement of the indigenous people in his journal and the number of people that it would take for him to enslave the entire population. And this is something that he says, you know, as soon as he really just steps off the boat, this is one of the things that comes to mind immediately. The other thing that he mentions that I think a lot of people also forget about is that he gives thanks to God for blessing him and the other explorers, as we call them, with the with this ability to enslave. And so there's also a sense of you know, righteousness when it comes to European explorers being able to exploit the land and the people of lands that they encounter. They feel it was their God-given right to do that. And so a lot of this rhetoric you hear over and over again, you hear it with the so-called pilgrims that landed in Massachusetts. Same type of religious talk as well.
What's it like for a student to have these notions that they've, in many cases, grown up with from a very young age, blown away? And I imagine that a lot of them struggle with that.
Yeah, I mean, I hear a lot of the same thing. You know, a lot of students at first, they're really shocked by it. And I ask them to explain and to write a response to how they feel, and many of them say, you know, so one of the things that they always end with at the end of their responses is a question is why do we continue to celebrate Columbus Day? Why are we still doing this, you know? And for me, I always tell my students, and I tell them, hey, you know, the reason why we still celebrate it is because there has to be a movement, a grassroots movement, a mass movement across the U.S. to really oppose this, just very similar to the movement that we see against the Washington Redskins. It would take a movement like that to really get rid of the mascot and a movement to get rid of Columbus Day as a celebration. So in Seattle, the city council voted to proclaim the second Monday in October as Indigenous Peoples Day, traditionally the day that has been associated with Christopher Columbus. And I think what this does, even though it's just in the city of Seattle, we have to remember that Seattle is indigenous land, and there's a large, you know, indigenous population that still lives in Seattle. But not just there, but throughout the United States, a lot of indigenous people still exist. And I think that's something that we forget many times because it's not in the curriculum. It's not something that we talk about, and so since it's not in our mind, you know, it's erased. And indigenous people are erased from history, I think, especially with holidays like Christopher Columbus Day. We really, you know, really not only forget, but we erase their existence because we're not talking about the other side of the story when we talk about Columbus Day. We're only talking about one side, and that's a very Eurocentric side of the story.
What do you recommend for people who are looking to understand this history more? You mentioned Howard Zinn's book. Certainly, that's a great book to review if you're trying to learn all kinds of history. But how should people be studying these issues?
Well, I think people should be studying these issues from an indigenous perspective. I think that's something that a lot of the textbooks leave out. And so I think as historians, as instructors, as scholars, as activists, I think we should really think about how we want to approach these topics. And it's important for us to hear the indigenous people's side of the story. And so I think for one, that's one of the first things that we can do as instructors and as adults is really to think about, okay, well, what is it that we need to think about when we're teaching these subjects. There's a new book that just came out by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and she has a book. It just recently was published. It's called An Indigenous People's History of the United States. And so I'm planning to read that and hopefully maybe even use it in my courses in the future.
We talked with Preston Wood in the first part of the show about the Ebola outbreak and some of the hysteria that's developed. Something you just remarked on, I was wondering if you could give me some feedback on before I let you go. The idea that you point out here, and Preston mentions this as well, Europe as the great civilizer, when in fact so many civilizations and so many different cultures were decimated.
It's constantly stated is that, you know, the West brought civilization to the Americas. And again, that's something that I think is the opposite is true. It depends on what your definition of civilization is. And speaking of diseases, and things like the Ebola outbreak, European people brought a lot of diseases that indigenous people had no immunities to. And so, you know, thousands of millions of indigenous people were wiped out by diseases because they had no defense mechanism to it. And really, it was what some scholars call a genocide. Activists also call it that as well. And it's been very well documented, the number of people that have died. Entire populations were almost entirely wiped out, something that we're seeing, you know, if something isn't done, you know, this could happen again. We could have an entire civilization of people just entirely wiped out. And so this idea of civilization and modernity is really a threat to indigenous people in the sense that we don't think critically about what are the things that we're receiving? We could be receiving something that's very dangerous. And so I think we need to look critically at the things that we possess and the strengths that we already have in our own histories and our own civilizations that date back thousands and thousands of years. I would really love people to learn more about this history, learn more about Columbus, actually. There's a lot that a lot of people don't know about him. I think what people do know is the fairy tale version of history. And so, but not only learn more about Columbus and what really happened, but also learn more about the indigenous people, the Taino people from the islands of the Bahamas, and other indigenous people. For me, I think that's what's really important, especially around this time of October 12th, when people are going to be celebrating the arrival of Europeans to this continent. But I think in the United States, we're celebrating more than just the arrival of European people here. I think really what we're celebrating is the heroification of somebody like Christopher Columbus, who supposedly brought civilization, brought religion, brought the old world to the new world. For me, I think that's what we're celebrating in the United States. And I think as activists, as critical thinkers, we should really start to question, you know, what is it that is being celebrated? And do we want to continue to celebrate genocide? Do we want to continue to celebrate this type of outlook where it's really a Eurocentric outlook on history. Do we want to continue to do that? Or as revolutionaries in the United States, I think we should be looking at the world from the indigenous perspective and from oppressed people's perspective at a perspective of history.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.